This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Play the play on the show.
Are you familiar with the idea of runway, Paul?
Project Runway on Bravo?
No, not Project Runway and not an actual airport, but runway. Usually used in a startup investment style. How much runway is left? And the idea is, how much funding do you have before this thing has to take off?
Okay.
Before this thing has to fly on its own. How much runway is left with the Seahawks and Russell Wilson? It's not a perfect question because they've already taken off and they're airborne. So maybe it's how much gas is left in the tank. But how much runway is left in this relationship between the two of them? Is this the midpoint? Are we closing in on the end? Where are they at in their partnership?
You want it to be the midpoint. You mm-hmm. want it to be like the never-ending runway in Fast and Furious 6, where the plane is on the runway for a good 15 minutes of plot time. Because, Danny, I think you want to keep this thing going as long as you possibly can. And you should assume that you have the ability to do this as long as you possibly can, unless you think, first off, your quarterback's about to either retire or regress. Second off, if you have a quarterback on a rookie contract, maybe you go a little bit faster. And third, unless you want to get rid of the guy for reasons that we don't quite understand.
You don't want to get rid of the guy. And he's definitely not going to retire. The problem is that the guy back there in aisle three has kept hitting the flight attendant call button. Mm. Like, won't stop hitting the flight attendant call button.
And
you've checked on him a couple of times, and he keeps hitting it.
Stop.
He keeps hitting it, and he keeps asking, like, how much longer is this going to be? And you got to wonder, like, is this going to be one of those sort of trips with him? The reason I ask, and the reason that I think it's an important question, is because I agree with the first part of what you said, which is, hey, you want this to be the midpoint, and you do. You want this to be the midpoint in the journey. The second part you said, you have to assume it is. I don't know about that. I don't know if the best thing for a team right now is to assume that it's the midpoint in the journey. And that's kind of to bring in Daniel Jeremiah's voice. He was the guest on the Brock and Salk podcast this week. And from his appraisal, he looks at this as something that is much closer to the finish than it is to the beginning. This is much closer to the final act than it is the midpoint of the program. Here's Daniel Jeremiah, who works with the NFL Network, saying that he kind of sees this as a short-term marriage between quarterback and team.
That's why the Julio Jones thing to me made sense with them, which is just a full, all chips in, let's really go for this thing on this last run here with Russell. If not, you don't have any picks next year. If you wanted to at that point in time, if this whole thing doesn't work and you just, you're a one and done in the playoffs, or you don't make the postseason, the time would probably be right to make the trade and get some picks and try and rebuild this thing. So it definitely feels like this is a short-term marriage we have here with Russell and the Seahawks. And so if that's the case, let's make a run at it.
I do want to say again, it would only be a short-term marriage if the Seahawks chose that. I don't think they should. I'd also say, are we so affected by what New England's done over the last 20 years to assume that it's not going to happen again and that you have to do it now? And I bring that up because if you take a look over the last 20 years, I mean, most teams haven't been to many more than three Super Bowls. Pittsburgh and Seattle and New England, I mean, That's pretty much it as far as over the last 20 years. Pittsburgh and Seattle three times.
Seattle's the only team that's done it with multiple quarterbacks.
Right. That's true. That's a decent counterpoint. But are you going to find that next quarterback? Or do you want to
count on that? No, you can't count on that. You ask that, but that's the reasonable assessment, right? That's the reasonable. That doesn't account for how the person in the relationship feels. When you ask, have people been spoiled? Yeah, maybe. But the question right now for the Seahawks is not, have we gotten a reasonable return on our run with Russell? Are we going to be good long-term with Russell? Like, what's Russell going to be playing like in 5 years? It's that we encountered severe turbulence in this relationship several months ago.
I like that we're sticking with the planes.
What's the best way? What's the best way for us to maximize the amount of winning we can do with Russ? Is it to budget and say we're planning on Russ for the next 8 years? Like we think that's how long he's going to be an elite quarterback, and that's how long he's going to stay here, and we're going to hold on to him. You're going to have to pry him out of our cold, dead hands. Or is it to say, well, if we kind of stay in the same spot we've been in, this probably isn't going to last either. We can't just sustain good. If we go with the Aaron Rodgers, Mike McCarthy, hey, we're kind of at that plateau. If we don't get over this hump that we seem to be stuck on, this is going to end regardless. So it's time to throw caution to the wind.
And you could go about it that way, but you bring up the Packers. The last 30 years, that's the most successful franchise in the NFL, at least as far as being consistently successful every single year. They've had two great quarterbacks along the way, which definitely helps. They've made it also to three Super Bowls along that same stretch. So, okay, I suppose that you could decide, you know what, now we're going to change the way that we do things because for the next 2 years, we need to make it happen. But, I mean, here's what I'm looking at. And to stick with the plane analogy, generally when you're on a plane, you're not expecting somebody to get up from aisle three, as you said, and go over to the emergency exit and open it up mid-flight. And, I mean, that's what Russell Wilson has to do, I think, to potentially change the direction of where this plane's going to make that thing turn around or come crashing down.
Would you be willing to go with that risk that it's going to get worse with Russ?
Yeah, I would.
Call his bluff?
Yeah, because he cares so much about what other people think about him. I just have a hard time thinking that he's all of a sudden going to say, you know what? I don't care what people think about me anymore. I'm just not going to play unless they send me to where I want to go. Cares too much about numbers. Cares too much about legacy. There are a lot of things I think that are at play that mean that he would stay here for the long term. And, you know, if you can find a way to keep a team on this level for a long period of time, it's possible for that eventual Super Bowl run to happen again, right?
Are you sure? I don't know, man. And it's a question from the 360, the Mac and Jack's text line. It's a good one. Does it pay off to be pretty good every year in the NFL? Does it pay off to be pretty good? Because I think that's kind of at the root of it, is how do you get over the hump? And I'm not sure. I think eventually you can get stuck on the hump. Didn't Philadelphia get stuck on the hump with Donovan McNabb and Andy Reid? And they never really, I mean, they had the run of, was it four straight NFC championships that they went to?
That's a good run, though.
It is. And then they lost it. Terrell Owens came in and kind of blew up that team, and they never got back there. They never got back there to the point where McNabb got done. That you stay at that hump long enough, and I think it becomes poison.
It definitely can. And I mean, then that leads you to the question of, well, do you feel like the quarterback long-term is going to keep you in this position, or is it the head coach? And I know that there are lots of different opinions on that one, that's for sure. You can potentially find yourself in a spot like that, but for every Philadelphia, how about a Baltimore? Baltimore has been about the exact same level for like the last 20 years before they got Lamar Jackson, and they didn't have a very good quarterback. They hover around, and then that miraculous run happens in 2012. Now, it did take some fortune for that to happen. I mean, it took Raheem Moore basically just eating it on a Hail Mary by Flacco to send that game into overtime. One of the best football games I think that's ever been played, the Broncos and the Ravens, that double overtime game in those playoffs that ultimately saw Baltimore go on and win a Super Bowl. So you have a team like Baltimore on that front. There are teams that have sort of been hovering in that kind of zone for a while. The Giants twice, where they were good, not very good at times too. Random runs can happen. You have a great quarterback, you will always have a chance at one of those out-of-nowhere surprise kind of runs. You don't necessarily need to be the unbelievable favorite in the NFL. And, I mean, I just don't see how you become a Kansas City with the way that things are in the league these days. Like, you're going
to
need...
I'm much more inclined right now. I'm much more inclined to throw caution to the wind right now for these next 1 or 2 years. Wow. I'm much more inclined to take the Daniel Jeremiah, this is a short-term marriage approach. Let's see if we can get it to pay off. Because I think the outcome of this upcoming season is going to I think it's going to determine the future of it. I think that Russell Wilson's future with Seattle depends on them getting further and at least winning one and maybe two games in the playoffs.
Right now, do you think they'll get further?
Yeah, I do. I think they'll get further. I think they've been a better team, and I think that they've had poor performance slash been things have broken against them in the playoffs. I think that they've been a better team than they've showed in the playoffs their past three times there. I think that they will be better in the playoffs this time around. It's Danny and Gallant. It's time for us to get to Front Page News.
This is the Front Page. Today's top two stories and why they matter. Every morning at 7:10, get what you need to know to start your day right now.
Do you want to know how not to answer a question?
Yes.
When you're asked a simple yes-no question, if you hem and you haw and you decline to answer, you're answering the question in the worst way possible. Example, Garrett Cole asked if he had ever used spider tack, which if you haven't been paying attention is a compound of four different substances used to give you super sticky grip. Has he ever used spider tack? Asked a very specific, have you ever used it? Here is the Yankees hurler.
Have you ever used spider tack while pitching?
I don't.
Oh boy.
I don't know. I don't know if.
Oh no.
I don't know quite. I don't quite know how to answer that, to be honest.
Then don't.
I mean, there are customs and practices that have been passed down from older players to younger players, from the last generation of players to this generation of players.
That's the excuse? That's the excuse you're giving?
Look, I joined the Secret Handshake Club, and they taught me how to cheat. We're all cheating. We're all cheating. But I don't want to say it because we're all cheating.
What do parents always tell you? Don't follow the kid off a cliff. All right, you're going to follow all these other pitchers off the cliff into the cliff of cheating? Just because they're all doing it? Man, that was a terrible answer, Danny. What was he thinking? Oh, man.
I wish I'd used this with my parents. My mom comes home. Did you use your stepfather's car? Because it looked like something was left in the trunk. I don't know how to answer that. I don't. There are
no, it works.
There are certain customs of teenagers that have been passed down through the years. I don't really know what I'm supposed to say.
You've convinced me. You've convinced me. Good job, Danny. By the way, I mean, just basically, with this admission, if you go to doctoring the baseball in the MLB rulebook, 10-game suspension. That's what's supposed to happen. A ejection and a 10-game suspension if you intentionally damaged, defaced, or discolored the baseball by rubbing it with any type of foreign item or substance. That's basically an admission, isn't it?
Should be.
The Front Page.
Well, in the NBA, we have a new MVP. Nikola Jokic of the Denver Nuggets.
Nikola!
He's the first center to win the MVP award since Shaquille O'Neal did in 2000. So, pretty interesting to see he's the one that's bringing it home instead of somebody traditional like Giannis or Kevin Durant or one of those giant wings that has the ability to shoot. We also had some games last night, Danny, and you are not a fan.
I hate
not a fan of Trae Young.
I hate Trae Young.
I love him.
I like the attention he's bringing. He's certainly taking a star turn. He cheats, man. Like, that dude flat out cheats.
Yeah, that's true.
The way he jumps into players when he's driving and then flops is ridiculous. Like, he is a flat out soccer diver. It's not embellishing contact. It's not. He creates a situation that makes it look like he's been shoved hard to the and draws fouls. It's gross.
Yeah, it's bad. But I enjoy the troll side of him. I really do. It's a shame that they got blown out the way that they did in Game 2 of that series.
It's not a shame. They deserve to get punked. I'm rooting for Philly in that series, man.
Nah, I can't. Can't
Shake
do it.
Shake Milton came in and gave him 18 in the second half.
By the way, the Mariners lost to the Tigers. They're in timeout.
What do you mean?
I'm not saying another word about them. Not today.
Why? Why? Because they lost?
They're 0-4 against the Tigers. How? The Tigers are awful. Ugh.
You're not going to. I will not talk about you until you beat win a game against the Tigers.
Dude, AJ Hinch is now beating you with the Tigers.
He's got the Mariners number. That is front page news. Let's get to the professor. John Clayton hops in. It's time for our morning drive.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the professor, John Clayton.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
Professor, I'm being a little bit of an online detective here. I'm trying to figure something out. Chandler Jones was with the Arizona Cardinals for Media Day. He had pictures taken of him with J.J. Watt, but later on in the day, he was not with the Cardinals for mandatory minicamp. Cliff Kingsbury says he isn't expected to be there Wednesday or Thursday either, and linebacker Jordan Hicks, who also wasn't there, has already been given permission to seek a trade. Is it possible that we're going to see Chandler Jones get traded?
No, I don't see it. I think there's a possibility he's going to hold out. This is the last year of his contract, and it sounds like he wants to get a big contract. I don't think this is anything to do with boycott or anything else. I think this is more contract-related. But, you know, they can't trade him. He's one of the most valuable pass rushers in the league, and I just don't see that. Again, the defense right now still is one of the big questions for the Arizona Cardinals. And, you know, Hicks, of course, because of the first-round selection, is now vulnerable, and you can understand why he's not going to be probably with the team. But in the case of Chandler, I think it's a contract negotiation thing.
All right, John. As Green Bay turns, the flower, Matt LaFleur, he says, we'll do whatever we can to, quote, help remedy the situation with Aaron Rodgers. I got an idea for him. I want you to see if maybe your connections, you can pass this along. You can tell me if it's a good suggestion. Here's how Matt LaFleur can help remedy the situation. Come out and say, Jordan Love is terrible. I don't know what they saw in this quarterback when they drafted him, but it's a giant mistake on the part of our franchise. I'll tell you what, even if he was great, we shouldn't have drafted him, but he's not even particularly good, and we drafted him. This is horrible. Please come back, Aaron Rodgers. I think that might help remedy the situation.
May make it worse. And the reason,
oh, really?
Well, the reason is like, Aaron, I don't think, wants to be there. And still, I think he's going to continue to do that. And this is the quarterback that you're stuck with. And so if you throw him under the bus, then all of a sudden it's like, okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, if you basically say this guy can't play and then you're forced to play him, how's that going to work out? that's a problem. I mean, the thing to do is trade him. Just get him off the team. That would be the smart thing to do. But to throw him under the bus when, again, he may be driving the bus is not a good idea.
Professor, I want you to grade Davante Adams backing/tiptoeing across the very delicate, as he put it, Aaron Rodgers situation. He said, I'll stand on the bleeping mountain and scream on the mountaintop that I've got Aaron's back. But then he said a little bit later, I think any general manager, any president, any owner, they should want the type of guys that are backing their players, especially a player like that. That's just a good trait to have. It's not like I'm saying forget the front office, like I don't respect what they have going on. Grade that walking of the fence.
Yeah, well, I think it's probably an A-, something in that nature.
Nice.
Yeah, because what you're looking at is that, so what did he do in response to Aaron Rodgers? Well, he didn't show up until just the mandatory minicamp, and he also said, I don't want to lose any money. So he shows up at the mandatory minicamp, but also in the meantime, he and the four other receivers, the top five receivers, they missed time, but they're showing up. But remember, he's also in the last year of the contract.
Yeah, that's true.
He had Aaron tell him, it's like, hey, I want to let you know, I'm not going to be with the team this year. Take that into account when you're negotiating with the Packers. And so you can kind of see his response, not showing up for the OTAs, showing up for the mandatory mini camp, and then putting himself in a position where it's like, okay, if Aaron's not going to be here, I'm not going to be here next year.
Professor, the 49ers have been stung by injuries. It looks like it's happened again. Justin School tore a knee ligament. He's the backup left tackle to Trent Williams. And then safety Tarvarius Moore tore his Achilles tendon. That's a bummer for them.
It is, and it continues, because this will be like the third straight year they continue to have problems with injuries. I went back and looked at my missed starts notes from last year, and they led the league with 117 missed starts. And again, the way I count them is that if the starter is out for the rest of the season, like Weston Richburg, the center, I don't count his replacement coming back in and those injuries. And so they had 117, which, of course, tore them down. Really, in the last like 8-9 years, they've led the league in ACL tears. Mm. And school had that was not just a ligament tear, it was an ACL tear. And so it just continues for them. I still remember last year when they were doing some training and they took a whole bunch of guys, went to Nashville on the offensive yes. side of the thing, and they had like 2-3 guys suffered major injuries.
Yeah.
It's like stress fractures and things of that nature. So I don't know what it is, but they cannot shake the injury bug.
Yeah, that's something else. By the way, John, one of the interesting things I heard about Julio Jones, and I don't know if this is part of smear tactics or anything before or after the trade, is that one of the reasons, I guess, that Atlanta, I guess, was wondering about his future was because he's not somebody that regularly shows up to practice, and they, I guess, managed his workload in a way that during the regular season he wasn't at a lot of those.
That one I don't know. That's foreign to me. I don't know if that's the case because he's always been a good guy during his career.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine Dan Quinn arranging it. I mean, I can see him, you know, making it easy for him. And of course, one thing, and you see even last year with the Seahawks and everybody else, it's like now starting to get to the point when you have somebody in their 30s. I mean, you give him a rest day here. You know, you don't have him practice the entire time. I've never heard him be mad at him for being late for meetings or not showing up at meetings and stuff like that. I can see if you're going to be a veteran like him, and as you get older, you kind of manage his time. So if it is something in that regard, it's not, but it's more coach oriented than player oriented. The big thing is, I think, you know, he was upset that for some reason that, you know, he didn't get more money under a contract right now. It's one of the highest in football at $22 million a year. And he started complaining last year and wanted out.
Yeah, that definitely has happened. John, we got a suggestion from the Mac and Jack's text line. I kind of like this from the 360. If I was Aaron Rodgers, I would just mail in a cashier check for the fines for missing minicamp and training camp. Just prepay that bad boy and keep vacationing. That would be a pretty gangster move.
That would be good. Like, yeah.
I'm not going to be here. By the way, I'm not going to be there in August either. Here, this should cover my tab. You let me know when you guys are going to trade me because I'm not coming.
Yeah, I think that wouldn't be a bad idea. I think that'd be a good thought. It's kind of like that's even stronger than what Carson Palmer did in 2011 when he says, listen, I have $80 million in the bank, and I'm never stepping into Mike Brown Stadium again. So it's like, Aaron, it wouldn't be a bad idea to do that. And remember, he can do that because he's got more money than Carson Palmer did in the bank, and he also has the $6.8 million roster bonus that he collected in March.
Professor, we always appreciate it. The dollars and cents that you provide, invaluable, and the insight. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay, thanks.
That is John Clayton. You can hear him this afternoon with Wyman and Bob. You can also follow his work, 710sports.com. DK Metcalf's back, running routes, not sprints. He gave us some hints about what to expect from this offense. Keyword, you'll hear it next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
DK Metcalf's back in our lives. It's wonderful.
Thank goodness.
He is by far the most entertaining Seahawk at this point in time, correct? I feel like he's got just a perfect blend of understatedness with cockiness at the same time. And when he's on the football field, of course, we just like that he gets everybody so riled up.
Jamal Adams got a shot to be that kind of presence, right? Jamal Adams not there as far as we know yesterday. I hate to read too much into those things because it's a daily, it could fluctuate, who knows. But from what we know, Jamal Adams wasn't there yesterday. But Jamal lit up a cigar in a post-game press conference. I enjoyed that. So, but DK, yeah, he's got some star quality. He's got some swagger.
That said, this is the time of year when you hear anybody talk about a new offense where you should always take it with all the grains of salt that you possibly can. This word that DK Metcalf used to describe the offense got a chuckle out of me, Danny.
I mean, it's very intricate, but he's a hungry coach, and that's what I like about him. He's always trying to learn something new, not only about the players, but, you know, about the game of football and about offense, and always coming up with new ways to just try to, you know, get his playmakers the ball.
Remember earlier this offseason when we did not want to hear the word creative?
Yeah.
This is another way to say creative, isn't it?
Yeah. We're at the point, are we going to learn anything about what Waldron's doing on offense?
Well, from the sound of things, Shane Waldron's putting in routes that no one has ever seen before.
It's a lot of different kinds of routes that, you know, people haven't seen, you know, from either team that he's coached. So I'm just excited to, you know, get to work with him and get to, you know, hone in on those other skills.
There's not new routes, right?
No.
What he's saying is there's things that he's calling that don't look like what he didn't just bring the Rams offense here. He didn't just bring, like, there's some things that he has brought that are part of his offense or his ideas for how he would run an offense when he had a chance.
Right. And I imagine there are some differences with this offense. The idea of new routes that have never been seen before.
We're going to do a double loop-de-loop?
Yeah.
And there's nine routes, right? There's nine routes.
Pretty
there's
much.
Nine routes, and they've been there through the course of time. And I guess you can do a slant and go and call it a sluggo. But yeah, there's a finite number of routes that you can use.
Run the old flippity-floop and the scoobity-doop-doop-dee-wop. Yeah, so we'll see. But we had a conversation about this yesterday, Danny. What is a change that you expect out of the offense this coming season? Because we did hear from DK that one of the reasons that some of the veterans, after a conversation, did decide to come back was so that they could learn the new offense. So they come back. They're studying.
I mean, it's a new offense. So, you know, a lot of different new things to learn. So, I mean, that's why one reason why we're here, you know, in OTAs is just to, you know, get our feet wet with the offense. It's just trying to, you know, take care of as many mistakes as we can early. So, you know, during the season, during training camp, it's going to be smooth sailing.
So clearly there's some new things that are taking place, and there are some things that involve learning. Otherwise, would they have even shown up for OTAs at all?
I don't think we're going to learn anything about what this offense is actually going to look like for the next couple months. I think we're going to hear a lot about it, and I think we're going to hear a lot of window dressing and florid descriptions about how fun, how exciting, and how all of these. I think we've reached the tipping point where I don't know how much any of what we hear over the next 2 months is going to actually predict what's going to happen on the field. I think it's going to reflect their hopes. I think it's going to be sort of the when you ask a kid what they want to be when they grow up. But I'm not reading too much into how accurate any of this is as a forecast. I don't think it's a good forecasting tool.
Right, especially quotes, but what we see out there as well. We're not going to really see it until
it's going to be against air,
game.
Right?
Yeah,
like you can, and that's part of the challenge of all of the preseason coverage. Is I think you can identify the questions a team has to answer. I don't think you can predict the answers based on what you hear in July and what you see in August, because you don't know what it's going to be like when the popcorn's popped, as Gary Payton used to say, like when there's actual resistance to it, and that'll be it. But I think you can frame the questions. Here'd be my question. How much more up-tempo is it going to be? How much more tempo are they going to put into this offense? I have always thought that Russell Wilson works better when they go faster. And I've been puzzled at times that they don't do that more frequently. I would like to see them play at a faster pace.
That's the thing that he has pushed for perhaps more than anything since I have come here. And it is surprising that they have
totally,
not gone
I
to that
I totally
more.
Agree with him. And I think some of that is that Pete doesn't mind a grinded-out style. I also think that was Brian Schottenheimer's background. The Rams played at a pretty good pace. I wouldn't describe them as breakneck. Like, the fastest team we've seen play was, like, the 2012-2013 Patriots. Like, they would really step on the gas and go. Holmgren's Seahawks would really go. I've always thought that Seattle, a lot of times in games, they start to look better when they go no huddle at the end of a half. And you're like, do that more. Run the good offense.
I'm guessing that Pete's reluctance has to do with the idea that what happens if you go three and out when you're up-tempo? What happens if you don't give the defense a break? And you saw how that really backfired when Chip Kelly did his Philadelphia experience, where his defense was essentially playing one full game more than every other single defense in the league based on snaps.
See, I think it's because he wants to get games to the fourth quarter, especially on the road. Like, if you gave him a chance to fast forward to the start of the fourth quarter and tell you you're down three to start the fourth quarter, I think he'd take it every time. He wants to keep things close, and he believes that the other team's going to buckle. I don't think that's the best way to play with this
team. I don't think that's the best way to play for anybody.
If you've got a defensive-oriented team, if you've got a hard-hitting, like, buckle your seatbelt and let's go, like, smash it, I can see that. Or if you think that our offense really isn't that high-paced, Seattle's strength is its offense, and specifically its vertical passing game. The more possessions, the better for the Seahawks.
I get that, but at the same time, the more possessions, that means the more times that your defense is going to be on the field and they're going to have to make stops. And if the defense isn't good enough, which has been the case for the last couple of years, that's a problem.
Yeah, but you outscore them. I mean, that's your strength is the offense. If you have a better offense than defense, you're best off having as many possessions as possible. Trying to control the ball is a fool's errand because you want your offense to get more opportunities, believing that you're going to score more frequently.
Okay. Well, yeah, I see that logic. I definitely do. I just feel like sometimes it's, hey, let's try to... That's, I think, what Chip Kelly was trying to do. I mean, I feel like he was trying to go for that. And maybe Philadelphia's offense wasn't quite good enough for that. Seattle has the personnel, I think, at least from a skill position standpoint, to try and do some of those things. Kansas City, obviously, is doing something similar to that. But that's the question. Like, how close are you to Kansas City? Because it's easy for them. I don't think it's quite as easy for Seattle as we've seen over the last couple of years. Otherwise, wouldn't they do this? Wouldn't they be more willing to go about it this way?
Well, isn't that why they changed offensive coordinators? That's what
probably.
I hope. If I would say questions, like, I want to see more tempo. I want to see more tempo in their offense. And that would be one of the things that I would identify is, like, are they going to play at a faster clip?
If you play faster, theoretically, that would help this team out. And I think more importantly, just being able to be consistent for the entirety of the year, I think that's something that Shane Waldron's going to have to learn on the fly. How do you keep an offense unpredictable for the entirety of 16 games? That was, excuse me, now 17 games, now that Brian Schottenheimer is gone. It's Danny and Gallant. He is Danny O'Neill. I'm Paul Gallant, 710 ESPN Seattle. It's that time. You're not just hearing stories about with buzzwords like intricate and creative about offenses. You're also hearing about how players have changed their lives entirely. One Seahawk in particular has. You'll hear how next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
I don't have any delusions about my ability as a rapper. I could do Sendog's job, though, on Cypress Hill.
Oh.
Insane in the brain! He's insane! Got no brain!
I'll just let you keep going on that one.
Insane in the brain!
Grade that a C minus? It's passing?
Of Sendog? That's a solid Sendog.
Oh, I think I think that Sendog is great at it.
It is time for one of the pillars of off-season coverage in the NFL. All sports, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
It is a cornerstone of your training camp coverage. Welcome addition to any young athlete's repertoire. It is the best shape of my life story. And one of the main components of the best shape of my life story is what? It's nutrition. Welcome Jordan Brooks to an illustrious club that includes Jaron Reed, who cut out pork, stopped eating barbecue heading into his second year. Includes Rashad Penny, who talked about the fast food he didn't eat. And most recently, Justin Dunn, who underwent food allergy testing, determined that he was allergic to eggs, and showed up to spring training this year in what the best shape of his life. Jordan Brooks, second-year linebacker for your Seattle Seahawks. Here he is, eating better.
Definitely the nutrition side. I would say last year kind of got off my diet a little bit, but definitely been eating a lot better, slimmed down, leaned down a lot. Feeling good.
Slim
yeah,
down.
Yeah, you are.
Lean down.
Feeling good. Looking good, Jordan.
He played pretty well last year.
He did. I just crack up at these because there's a template for him. Like there is, and that's not to say that it doesn't matter because I think it does. But pretty much, if I was going to come up with a playbook for someone covering a football team, I would say that, hey, in the first 2 weeks of training camp, go up to all the second year guys and ask them what they learned about nutrition, and then write a story about that. Because you would have this extensive thing, and it is true. Like guys in the NFL specifically will typically, from their first to their second year, undergo a pretty significant change in what they eat. There are some exceptions. Julian Peterson, who, if you remember him, was a linebacker with the 49ers, came to Seattle. One of the most incredible athletes I've ever seen. That guy ate like trash from beginning to end. Like, that guy, he'd eat a whole box of Cinnamon Toast Crunch, a glazed donut, and like a bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit in the morning. He loved the Baconator from Wendy's. But usually pros between their first and second year start to understand what they need to put in their bodies.
I guess everyone eats a lot of fast food, huh? Yeah, I've cut all that stuff out a while ago, so I feel like it shouldn't be that hard for these athletes to potentially go down those roads. Does it ultimately net results? Generally, I would say it's mixed, because I have remembered athletes in the past who have switched to vegan diets, and those became hot button issues. Oh, is he getting enough meat? Why is he getting hurt all the time? Arian Foster, well, specifically.
That's because people are idiots about
yes.
that, though, right? Like, I mean, that's a silly sort of bias against. And look, it's fun to make fun of hippies. I do it a lot. But like, when you assume that because someone's vegan, they're getting injured more, that's pretty silly.
You need iron, bro.
Yeah, there's not any sort of a backbone to that. My favorite diet story ever was Lendale White. Lendale White lost 20 pounds. This was when he was with the Titans, and they asked him why, and he stopped drinking Patron. He cut tequila out of his diet. And actually, it became such a popular story that by the time he got to Seattle, he no longer liked to talk about the Patron diet, where he stopped drinking tequila, because he realized it just made him look like he was a big sloppy drunk before he stopped drinking the tequila, which I was like, no, man, much respect to you. Like, I think that that's great that you recognize that. But that was, I feel that there is, in general, and in the NFL specifically, between your first and second year, you see players dramatically revise how they eat.
Yeah, and I'm curious to see if there's anybody else. What did DK go from last year to this year? But I ultimately...
DK looks... You can't... DK's...
You think
DK's,
he changed his diet up at all?
I don't know, but I'm not... I can tell you this. You're not going to be able to see it. Like, the guy's going to get more ripped. Like, I don't think you can. His
you
abs
want to be more
abs.
Ribs. Yeah, well, you want abs on your abs on your abs.
Nah, no. It's the guy that you look like is slightly doughy, and all of a sudden he comes in the next year, and he is lean and explosive.
Well, that's what Jordan Brooks is right now, so watch out.
Gerrit Cole yesterday was asked, and he became... I'm not sure how he wasn't prepared for this question. The hot button issue in baseball this week, thanks to a Sports Illustrated story, is pitchers using sticky substances on their hands to get a better grip, to spin the ball better, and thereby have their breaking stuff break sharper. Gerrit Cole is asked, you'll hear the question, he's asked about spider tack, which is a compound. There's another one called pelican dip grip. They're basically combinations of whether it's sunscreen and rosin, pine tar, and it's a compound that is meant to be very, very sticky. Here is Gerrit Cole's answer to whether he had ever used this specific substance, spider tack.
And have you ever used spider tack while pitching?
I don't quite know how to answer that, to be honest.
It's like watching a car crash.
I mean, there are customs and practices that have been passed down from older players to younger players, from the last generation of players to this generation of players. And
he even starts laughing there. You can sort of hear it.
Now, the better answer for him, I think in the back of his mind, all he's remembering is all the dudes that got up and lied to Congress about steroids and how bad they looked later when it was clear they were lying. So he's like, don't lie, which is fairly admirable, right? Like, the desire not to lie and to say, okay, I'm going to operate in the gray area. Like, that's the better answer, though, clearly is for him to say, look, it's been understood and accepted for a long time in baseball that pitchers use things on their hands to get a better grip. I've been no more and no less guilty of that than most other pitchers in this game. And if we want to change that, then we should have an honest conversation about that. But you probably actually need to ask what you just asked to Rob Manfred and not to me. Right? Like, that would be a better answer.
It would be a better answer, but he would still be getting crushed because he would be one of the ones that confirmed that he is doing this. No one wants to be the one that admits it, right?
But you, if everybody's doing it, and maybe this is baseball's fault because there's been such a wink and nod agreement. Because when
with everything.
There are rules. There are rules that prohibit you from putting a substance on your hand and having it come in contact with the baseball. You're not allowed to put something, a foreign substance, on your hand and deliberately rub it into the baseball. You're not allowed to do it. But, well, pitchers, you see them lick their hands all the time as long as they're not on the rubber and all of these. And it's basically there's been a wink and a nod agreement that this has been accepted. And now it's to the point where it's a problem. Baseball needs to answer that. Garrett Cole looks like a moron. Like, he looks really dumb. But I don't know if I blame Garrett Cole so much as I blame baseball.
Baseball's unwilling to go all the way when it comes to implementing the rules that they've put in. Take, for example, remember that rule about how you weren't supposed to, as a batter, be able to call timeout, step out of the batter's box, do all of those things at least as much? That was completely ignored by star players, and umpires didn't force them to stand in the box. You have seen the same thing with I think, all sorts of different things in baseball where umpires could enforce it, and they choose not to. This would be another one. I mean, I guess you would be trying to do this every single time. That's the problem. I guess they don't. It's sort of like how in the past we've seen certain NFL teams perhaps grab and grab and grab all game long because they knew that the referees weren't going to call holding or pass interference if you do it every single play. It's gotten to that point where I feel like the umpires maybe think that there's no stoppage in action where they can actually step in and say, you can't do this anymore.
It's Danny and Gallant. It is Wednesday. It's Bump Day. We'll ask Bump if he's ever putting anything sticky on a ball. Hopefully he's got a better answer than Garrett Cole next.